This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Should you be curious about the place of America in the global economy, might I refer you to the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, featuring an article from the pen of the current occupant of 1500 Pennsylvania Avenue entitled America and the Global Economy, A Case for U.S. Leadership. The author is one Jacob Liu. He goes by Jack, or to me, Mr. Secretary of the Treasury, that is. Sir, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
You have written here a manifesto, basically, for America as the indispensable economic nation. But we're doing it in a changing world, you point out. And it seems to me that what you're talking about here is us giving up some economic influence so we can get some economic influence.
Actually, I don't think it's about giving up anything. I think that what we've done over the last 70 years is we've worked to build institutions that promote both American values and American interests. And we have to make sure that we maintain that ability going forward. So what I'm saying is we have to make sure that we don't see countries pulling away from a system that very much promotes American interests. We need to make sure they stay in it and that all the changes are changes that we think are in our U.S. interest.
This is the system of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the system that came out of World War II. How do you convince countries to stay in it when, as you point out in the first paragraph of this piece, it took the Congress of the United States 5 years to agree on reforms to the International Monetary Fund?
You know, the interesting thing, Kai, is that I think the world wants us to play this role. I think that what...
That's a gutsy statement.
Over these last 5 years, I had to explain over and over and over again why it was taking so long. The desire was for the U.S. to ratify the IMF reforms and for the IMF to remain the centrally important institution that it is. I actually think that if you look at the structure of the IMF quota reforms, it tells a really interesting story.
Quota reforms are how much voting power.
That's how much voting,
has.
What your share in the IMF is.
Right.
And you know, 5 years ago, there was an agreement where essentially the U.S. went down a tiny, tiny bit, by a small fraction. And other countries in the world were really juggling around their shares, their position, to reflect the shift mostly from Europe to emerging economies. So here you had winners and losers in the United States that was, compared to the others, staying the same, yet we were having a hard time passing it through Congress. It was profoundly in the U.S. interest to have this take place, for the emerging countries to feel invested in the system where the other developed countries were prepared to go along with it. That's exactly the point of my piece. That's why we have to be engaged and we have to make sure that we do the things that are smart to keep everyone else engaged.
You are making the case for American engagement internationally at a time when domestically income inequality is up, wages have been stuck for decades. And I wonder how you think that's going to play back here at a time when in this political season, free trade and internationalism are taking a beating on both sides of this election campaign.
The last few decades have seen an awful lot of pressures coming to bear on middle-class families in America, middle-class workers in America. And it's not just trade. It's more broadly globalization.
Right.
It's the modern technologies that are changing the shape of what the workplace looks like and what people do at work. And frankly, it's been economic policies and economic crisis that have taken a toll on a lot of middle-class families. I mean, if you came out of the Great Recession having lost your life savings, where it was in the equity in your home, if you graduated from high school and college during the recession and couldn't find a job right away, or if you were 50 years old and you lost your job, those are deep scars. I'm not surprised. Now, we have policy solutions that really do work there, but it's not cutting America off from the world. The growth in the global economy is growth that ought to provide future jobs for American workers, both in services and in manufacturing. That's what we need to make sure is the opportunity that's open.
It ought to provide it. But if this issue of foreign affairs lands on some kitchen table in Ottumwa, Iowa, with some auto worker or some farmer or some machinist who's been out of a job for years and can't find work, how do you make the case that this is what's good for the American economy?
I think that if you look at the economic growth in the last 50 years, you know, we have seen around the world lifting people out of poverty, creating conditions for a more peaceful world, for a world where the United States could have enormous markets to sell into, both goods and services. And the fact that it has been very hard for that auto worker is something that we have to ask, what do we need to do as a matter of domestic policy? First of all, there has to be fair trade. It cannot be that the U.S. auto is competing against an auto that is unfairly subsidized by practices which in a good trade agreement aren't allowed. Secondly, we have to make sure that we have the kinds of policies here at home where we provide people with the skills they need to get the jobs that are available in the economy, and where we build the infrastructure in our own society so that we can have a growing economy in the future. I think the idea of cutting us off from the world would ultimately shrink, not grow, the job opportunities.
All right, so that's the first chunk. Coming up in the second half of the program, what the Secretary of the Treasury had to say about too big to fail, about tax inversions and the fate of American companies in that global economy he was writing about. Also, by the way, his latest thoughts on the fate of the $10 bill. There were two recent and real-life examples of America and American companies in the global economy that I asked Treasury Secretary Liu about in the second half of our interview. The first was the unsealing last week by a federal judge of her ruling that removed MetLife, the big insurance company, from the government's official list of companies that are too big to fail, a listing that for the companies on it imposes increased costs and regulatory obligations. The judge in the case said the government's decision-making in putting MetLife on the list was arbitrary and capricious, her words, fatally flawed, also her words, and she called on the government to fully explain its rationale. So my question to Secretary Liu was, why is it so hard for the government to decide and describe what is too big to fail and what is not?
Well, Kai, on that ruling, obviously we disagree with it and the government is appealing. But let me take a step back and just remind everyone what was at issue, what is at issue in this decision. You go back to the financial crisis in 2007, 2008. Nobody expected the companies that failed to fail. They were not sitting on the edge of disaster, AIG and Lehman. It was a surprise. It came out of the blue for most who were watching. Part of Wall Street reform said that should never happen again. We need a process where you're not looking for how likely is it that a firm would fail. You're looking at if a firm fails, could it bring the whole economy to its knees? We went through that process in a very careful way and have designated not hundreds, but, you know, roughly less than a dozen firms, very big, very interconnected firms. The decisions are hundreds of pages long with detailed analysis. I think it will withstand review, but I think the question we have to ask is, do we ever again want to face the possibility of a firm's failure putting at risk the whole economy? And that's why it's so important that we get this right.
The answer, obviously, is that we don't want that. The question, though, was, why is it so hard for the government to say this is what systemically important financial institutions mean?
You know, I think
because the judge said you didn't do it.
I think that, well, without getting into all the detail, there are certain aspects of the ruling that I think are just incorrect. And I think, you know, take, for example, the premise, should we have to show that it's likely a firm will fail? No. These are very unlikely events. That's one of the questions that the judge asked. Did you show that it's likely that the firm would fail? It was not likely that AIG would fail or that Lehman would fail. These are very remote possibilities with highly destructive consequences if it happens. So you're not really looking for the probability. You're looking for what is the consequence. That's what the statute tells you to look for. The question of looking at a cost-benefit analysis, the statute didn't have that requirement in it. That's not the measure that is being looked for. The consequences of a failure are immense, almost infinite in terms of the damage that the financial crisis in 07, 08 caused. One would never be able to predict with any kind of precision the scope of that kind of broad systemic failure. There's a reason that it wasn't put in the statute. I actually think the work was done correctly. I think the work was done well. And we're going to appeal, and it'll be up to an appeals court to decide.
Tax inversions. Last week, you came out with, I believe it's your third action on tax inversions, companies buying other companies overseas to change their tax liabilities. It, I guess, worked the way you wanted it to, because Pfizer and Allergan have called off their merger. Both of the CEOs of those companies, though, came out last week and said, we were playing by the rules that Congress made up, and now here's the Treasury Department coming in and changing them on us midstream. Isn't that sort of the antithesis of what your article is about, that we have to be able to adapt and play in a global economy?
Look, I think anyone who has listened to what I've said over the last two-plus years could not be surprised that we were looking to do anything we could do administratively to stop the pipeline of inversions. We took action twice administratively. It had some effect each time we did it. And each time we made clear that we were looking at taking additional action. And we even said that in the case of earnings stripping, we were looking at what could we do in that regard. I think that the right answer here is legislation. There's no doubt. I've been saying all along the only way to do it so that it sticks is legislation. I'm sure there are smart tax lawyers and accountants out there looking at for loopholes in the guidance we put out last week.
I get all of that, but don't you think this plays as the U.S. government going after two companies specifically with this administrative action?
We don't make policy based on individual companies. You look at the impact of this company, it sends a powerful signal in the future of what is permitted and what is not permitted. And the goal has been all along to stop the pipeline. We don't do it retrospectively. So if you closed a deal, if you completed a deal, I don't know what other deals are caught up in this. But, you know, I hope that we've stopped the pipeline for a while.
This piece did not come out of the Treasury Department speech writing shop. You wrote it yourself. And as we sit here under a bust, actually, of Alexander Hamilton, and with Hamilton all in the news, I wonder if this is Jack Lew's legacy piece right here.
You know, I have thought that you know, after 3 years of fighting a kind of quiet fight on the IMF quota reforms, dozens if not hundreds of conversations with congressional leaders, that there was a real burden to make a public case so that maybe this will be a little bit easier the next time. It has to be that there is a broader understanding of what we do to create the space for the U.S. to have the influence that we need for our economic and our national security. And I thought this was an appropriate moment to do it.
A little pride of ownership there. I see a smile on your face.
I'm proud to have been part of it. It's not all my work.
Mr. Secretary, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Good to be with you, Kai.